Hello and welcome to ID Talk, answers from an infectious disease expert. I'm Dr. Sean Elliott, a pediatric infectious disease specialist with Tucson Medical Center, professor emeritus of pediatrics at the University of Arizona College of Medicine, and long-term contributor to infectious diseases and immunizations topics at the Arizona chapter of the American Academy of Pediatrics. This podcast has been created to answer questions from our chapter's members about the COVID-19 pandemic and everything else infectious disease or infection prevention related. Thanks again for tuning in for everyone here in Arizona. And if you're tuning in from outside of Arizona, welcome as well. As always, another great list of questions to go through. First, just a brief update on where we're at with other infectious diseases out there. We continue to see a decline, thankfully, in respiratory viruses, although RSV, SARS coronavirus 2, adenovirus, rhinoentro, and all sorts of other fun things are still out there. So too, seeing a continuation of viral gastroenteritis, especially norovirus in this part of the country, and elsewhere, I'm sure, rotavirus as well. And still, a continued higher alert for invasive group A streptococcal infection, not just strep pharyngitis and related scarlet fever or rheumatic fever, but also invasive disease such as severe pneumonia, emphysema, sepsis, musculoskeletal infections, severe necrotizing fasciitis, etc., and so forth. So all those things are still absolutely out there. Thankfully, the numbers are overall decreasing, but still a higher alert than we usually experience for this time of year. Also still out there, and unfortunately a very, very active issue, is perinatal transmission or exposure to both syphilis and hepatitis C. Both of those are absolutely in much higher rates across the entire country. If you're interested in more information about that, we have a webinar through the Arizona chapter of the AAP coming up next week, April 12th at 12 o'clock our time. Several physicians from the CDC, as well as myself, will be talking about both congenital syphilis and hepatitis C acquired perinatally. So should be some very interesting epidemiology as well as clinical signs and symptoms, what to look for, and of course, an update on treatment and management of babies with hepatitis C and or congenital syphilis. So with that, to the questions. The first one takes us back to our not so very dear friend, monkeypox. So the questioner says, I read that there's been more than 500 monkeypox cases reported in the United States already in 2024. This is with the high case count surpassing last year's numbers, what should we be aware of? So yes, indeed, there is a mini surge of monkeypox cases so far this year in 2024. 2023 was sort of a smattering cases. Almost exclusively, these cases are still within the LGBTQ population, and especially men who have sex with other men. And of course, there may be, by extension, some secondary pediatric cases. Putting this into context, in 2022, when we had our significant both global outbreak and also outbreak here in the United States, there were over 32,000 cases reported here in the States in 2022. So in no way to minimize the 500 cases so far, but it is certainly a trend which bears watching. Of very important note, in 2022, that outbreak was largely ended or mitigated significantly by social behavioral practices within the LGBTQ population, which was an amazing use of acting safely and reducing risk of transmission. During that outbreak, however, and this is pertinent to the question, there were pediatric cases, most especially in infants being raised in or living in a household in which there was another infected household member or a primary caretaker. Monkeypox itself is very contagious via cutaneous or contact transmission. And so an individual themselves suffering from active monkeypox, perhaps in the absence of overtly fastidious hand hygiene, could transmit virus to a child, baby, adolescent, anybody else, via direct contact. This is not malicious at all. This is unfortunately just a harbinger of just how infectious or how contagious the virus is. So fast forward to today, I think what we should be aware of is that there is a slight chance that babies or children living in a household with another infected family member could be at risk to develop monkeypox themselves. If so, what you will see, first thing you will see, will be a large or a cluster of large pox-like lesions. So if you don't remember from 2022 or have not recently seen pictures even of smallpox, these typically are lesions that are easily a half to a full centimeter diameter in differing stages, some of which will be fresh, sort of what appear to be rounded, cloudy, fluid-filled bullae, all the way to hemorrhagic pox lesions, to those which have already unroofed and are starting to heal with the granulation tissue underneath. In monkeypox, these lesions are usually quite tender. So think that the child coming in with hand, foot, and mouth syndrome, which is not monkeypox, Coxsackie virus instead, but those lesions are similarly tender, and those patients will frequently be quite miserable, fussy, unable to eat or drink due to the oral lesions. In monkeypox, the lesions are almost exclusively cutaneous, so skin-related, but they may also be in the groin or perineal region, especially if the infected care provider is performing diaper changes. And that, in fact, is where more than several of the babies infected and affected in 2022 first developed their lesions. So there could be, you know, mucosal lesions or perivaginal, peripenile, perianal lesions, which again just simply implies contact via the hands from the infected provider. So if one has a patient presenting to your clinical site, wherever that may be, with new onset of pox-like lesions, the first question should be, are there others in the family who are actively experiencing these lesions? And also secondarily, what is the social makeup of people in the household? There may be, as there were in 2022, men having sex with men who were silently infected, did not know what to do about that, and they were brought to medical attention by the development of pox lesions and diagnosis of babies in their household. So I think keep the ears and eyes open and ask the epidemiologic questions, and certainly just be open and looking out for new onset pox lesions. If you have any questions about whether a lesion is or is not pox lesion, certainly you can compare and contrast to the multitude of pictures online, but also contact your local county health department, and also, as always, you're happy to help a pediatric infectious disease provider. All right, so thank you for raising that question. It's important to sort of let ourselves know that this is out there and it could be coming to a community near us. Okay, next question. In a recent article, 450 patients at Salem Hospital, or the Mass Brigham Center in Massachusetts, were exposed to hepatitis B, C, and HIV due to improper administration of their IV medications. What infection prevention steps can we follow to avoid this? So the questioner is alluding to a story which broke at the end of last year, multiple news stories, and it has to do with a class action lawsuit against Salem Hospital in Massachusetts after over 450 patients were exposed to those three viruses, basically bloodborne pathogens, due to what is described, and this is the only description we have, as an isolated practice at that hospital not consistent with best practices regarding the administration of IV sedation medications during endoscopy procedures. So we don't have any more information as to what exactly the practice was, but we can certainly intuit or suppose that there was likely use of a multi-use vial of a sedative, perhaps propofol or something like that, without properly cleaning the top or without exchanging needles. And thus there may potentially have been transfer of virus from one infected patient to the others as well, just during this process. As soon as the hospital realized this practice was occurring, it corrected it, and the release of notice to those 450 plus patients was out of a huge abundance of caution. As always, the risk is at best theoretic and at worst slightly real that they may have been exposed, but of course hospitals and any healthcare center are obligated both ethically and of course appropriately to share that potential exposure with their patients. So the hospital did so, and unfortunately it has turned into this class action lawsuit. So unfortunate, but I suppose silver lining is that we can take a slight morsel of education and take a look at our own best practices regarding shared use vials. In the pediatric world, this most often has to do, of course, with multi-use vaccine vials. And of course, I hope we're all quite aware that there are very strict rules about the use of clean needles to access those, cleaning in between, proper storage, etc., and so forth. If one is not immediately familiar with your practices in your clinical setting, now would be a good time to review those, not just for yourselves, but with everybody in the clinic practice setting just to make sure that we're following proper standard of care. And if you have questions about what that may be, certainly can easily access protocol by the CDC, by Society of Hospital Epidemiology and Healthcare, SHEA, and several others online, as well as perhaps, hopefully, maybe, you have the written policies and procedures in your own clinical setting, which you can access and review. So that is pretty much the proper steps to follow. As always, and again, without knowing what the specific isolated practice was, making sure that we practice good hand hygiene before and after accessing multi-use vials or delivering medications or accessing IVs, and of course, even before and after seeing patients. So I think paying attention to good best practices in general. So appropriate hand hygiene, appropriate use of IV management, IV medication management, all those can and should be reviewed just to make sure that we're not running the risk of transferring potential blood and body fluids from patient to patient. By the way, those 450 patients were exposed and this practice was in process over an almost two-year period. It's from June of 2021 to April of 2023 before it was discovered. So things like this can happen. They can happen insidiously. And that's why I encourage all of us to overtly look at our practices in our clinical setting and just make sure that we are up to par and up to standard. Okay, next question. We have a great wide range of things this week. So this questioner asks, with an increase in mosquito-borne illnesses, especially dengue cases in Puerto Rico and also in Brazil and certainly in South America, do you predict we will also see an increase in mosquito-borne illnesses in the United States? Yes, the answer is yes. Now, it should hopefully not be a huge outbreaks such as Rio de Janeiro is experiencing or has experienced or as Puerto Rico is experiencing right now. But I think we will continue to see individual isolated cases over the next couple years. Here in Arizona, we've had our first native or autochthonous case of dengue in Maricopa County in Phoenix. And we can anticipate that additional cases will occur. Certainly the mosquitoes which carry dengue, chikungunya, and Zika virus, that means the Aedes albopictus and Aedes aegypti mosquitoes, are already quite prevalent in the lower half of Arizona and even probably a bit further up as well. And that goes for those of you in states in the southern part of the United States. So the mosquito is absolutely present. And that's important because that mosquito has shown itself especially vulnerable to carrying those three viruses, dengue, chikungunya, and Zika. And also that mosquito is known for what is called a high vectorial ability, meaning that it can easily transmit a disease because it's quite omnipresent and its bite is painless. So unlike perhaps we all remember like those, you know, ankle biters or the ankle slappers, you know, in the early dawn or the late dusk twilight, those would usually be mosquitoes like the Culex and some others where the bite actually you can feel the burn, the bite itself. Unlike those, the Aedes mosquitoes have a painless bite, and they are day and nighttime feeders. So basically, they're out there all the time. And so trying to avoid being out at dawn or dusk is not going to help protect one from the bite of the Aedes mosquito. Also, this mosquito population is sometimes referred to as the floodplain mosquito, meaning that it can lie dormant in larval form in dried out, arid parts of the country, i.e. Arizona, until the rains come, which of course we've been having lots of, and then that can allow the larvae to mature in whole floods of mosquito outbreak. So once the mosquito population itself gets infected and transmits one of the viruses, then it gains an ecological toehold or a niche, and then we will start to see human cases afterwards. So this has happened with increasing regularity in southern Central America and even in the southern part of Mexico. For those of us listening from Arizona, there were absolutely cases of dengue and Zika across the border in the state of Sonora, Mexico. So it is only a matter of time when those viruses transmit into our local mosquito population and we will start to see human cases. This is not new news. In fact, this has been well-known, expected, and anticipated by the vector-associated infections branch of the CDC, and certainly by many of us who practice sort of infection prevention and infectious disease epidemiology. So in prior podcasts, and it's been a while, so maybe it's time to review this, we've gone over clinical signs and symptoms of what to look for. Just very briefly, all three viruses initially start as a flu-like illness, just like so many of the fabulously fascinating infectious diseases. But in the case especially of dengue and chikungunya, the fevers and malaise rapidly turn into severe polyarthralgias and myalgias. So dengue is called variably break bone or bone break fever, because patients hurt so badly they swear their bones are breaking within them. Chikungunya especially affects the peripheral joints, so think small joints of the hands and feet, which are incredibly excruciatingly painful, so patients become non-ambulatory and unable to use their hands. Zika, thankfully, is far milder than both dengue and chikungunya, and typically has those same peripheral polyarthralgias along with a flat erythematous macular rash and conjunctival injection with some serous discharge. So think for Zika virus, somewhat like adenovirus may appear, but add to that mild polyarthralgias. Typically in adults and adolescents, older children, Zika is a mild illness. In younger children, it may be even milder than that. The big concern with Zika, as I think we all remember, is that mothers who are infected with Zika virus can deliver a baby with severe microcephaly, so well below the third percentile, along with that all sorts of other neuronal migration defects, etc. and so forth. And rarely those patients with immunodeficiency or at risk due to other chronic illness who are adults or adolescents may develop things like Guillain-Barré syndrome or transverse myelitis or other neurologic complications from a routine Zika virus infection. So yes, questioner, thank you for asking. There are absolutely cases out there. We can anticipate in the next couple of years sporadic cases here in the southern part of the United States, and very potentially if we continue to be unable to control our mosquito populations effectively, we may yet have a cluster of cases occurring at some point in time in a community near you as well. Okay, last question. The FDA gave emergency use authorization to the monoclonal antibody product pemivibart. This is for pre-exposure prophylaxis for COVID. The questioner asks, is pemivibart given before or after COVID-19 exposure? And thank you for allowing me to clarify that. So pre-exposure prophylaxis, this product, this monoclonal antibody, so passive immunization, is intended specifically for patients 12 years of age and older and at least 40 kilograms who are not infected nor recently infected with SARS coronavirus 2, but who are moderately or severely immunocompromised and thus expected to have an incomplete response to vaccination. Very importantly, this product is not intended to be replacement intervention for vaccination. Those immunocompromised patients should still be vaccinated so that any even partial protection they develop may help prevent them from severe, invasive, or hospitalized disease. However, realizing that that seroprotective response in an immunocompromised patient may be imperfect or not adequate, this product is a new product replacing former monoclonal antibody products, which themselves had good efficacy but were aimed at older subvariants of SARS-CoV-2, those being the alpha, betas, and deltas. So pemivibart is specifically aimed as a monoclonal antibody at the spike protein of the Omicron subvariants with broad protective ability against what is currently out there and circulating. So ideally, the patient in your practice who is older than 12 years, more than 40 kilograms, and has a immunodeficiency or immunosuppression, either due to disease or medications like chronic steroid use, certainly those patients who are in remission from cancer treatments, any patient with known immunodeficiency, all those patients would deserve consideration of pre-exposure prophylaxis. So what do you do when we are currently still having cases out there, and yes, we are, of COVID-19? Those patients deserve an initial 4,500 milligram IV dose of pemivibart, which is given at least 2 weeks after a vaccination for COVID-19. Not saying that you need to vaccinate first, but hopefully your patients are also up to date with the most recent boosters, messenger RNA boosters, or the Novavax booster, to give them as much protection as possible. And then, assuming that is so, then they deserve this initial IV dose, which can be re-administered every 3 months to provide lasting passive immunoprotection against the circulating Omicron viruses out there. So there you go. Pre-exposure prophylaxis, it is not a treatment, it is not a vaccine, it is not a post-exposure prophylaxis. So by the time the patient went to that crowded birthday party and was exposed to SARS-CoV-2, by that time, it is too late. So perhaps now is the time to consider that if you have patients in your practice meeting those criteria. So once again, age older than 12 years, greater than 40 kilograms body weight, not yet infected, but is moderately or severely immunocompromised or immunosuppressed by either disease or medication. Those would be patients who deserve consideration of pemivibart given in its IV every 3 months. Okay, so that is it for the list of questions. Thanks again, as always, for listening to ID Talk. Arizona AAP members can submit questions for future episodes to covid@azaap.org. The Arizona AAP would like to acknowledge the generous support of this podcast by the Arizona Department of Health Services through the Title V Maternal and Child Health Services Block Grant funding. For more information and resources related to COVID-19 in Arizona, or to learn how to become a member, please visit us at azaap.org. In the meantime, and as always, thank you for tuning in. Keep those questions coming. Keep washing those hands. Refresh those updated practices and make sure we're all doing everything by standard of care. And keep eyes open for, of all things, monkeypox, congenital syphilis, and perinatal hepatitis C. And do remember, April 12th at 12 o'clock Arizona time is a webinar covering congenital syphilis and perinatally transmitted hepatitis C if you are interested. If so, find the access for that webinar on the Arizona AAP website. So thank you all for your service. Keep fighting the good fight. And we'll tune in next time.